Now, in a programme previously broadcast in December, Adhichar Chakraborty reports on the fight by economics students to reform their subject in teaching economics after the crash.
Breaking news here. Stocks all around the world are tanking because of the crisis on Wall Street.
Brought down by bad mortgage investments, Lehman, which has 25,000 employees, will be liquidated.
We're working to reduce disruptions and minimize the impact of these financial market developments on the broader economy.
In October 2008, as the banks collapsed and the world came apart, the most powerful economist on the planet, then head of the US Central Bank, Alan Greenspan, made this public confession.
I found a flaw. I don't know how significant or permanent it is, but I've been very distressed by that fact.
You found a flaw in the reality?
A flaw in the model that I perceived is the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works, so to speak.
In other words, you found that your view of the world, your ideology, was not right.
That's precisely the reason I was shocked, because I've been going for 40 years or more with very considerable evidence that it was working exceptionally well.
The man they called the maestro was freely admitting that the world economy was now in meltdown because he and his profession hadn't properly understood how it worked. The economic crisis was also a crisis for economics. That same autumn, Yuan Yang went up to Oxford University to study philosophy and economics. The 18-year-old soon noticed something wrong.
It wasn't very clear to me, a first-week student, how economics had gotten into this strange cul-de-sac.
Just when economics was at the top of every news bulletin, sparking rows in the pub, she and her fellow students were being instructed by their professors to ignore the meltdown.
It felt like when we're studying economics, we're being asked to go into a bubble. Sometimes our tutors actually said out loud, don't try to think about this in relation to current events, or don't try to think about this in relation to the news headlines you're reading right now.
Don't try and join us up to the real world at all.
Don't go for that. Just stop, you know, lazing around in the common room reading newspapers and go into the library and do your problem sets. So that was the position we've been presented with.
Undergraduates at top universities, on the conveyor belt to a top job, at a bank, a business, or a government department near you. Yet all painfully aware that even while the economic model outside looks badly broken, the economics models they're being taught have barely changed. Students like Diana Garcia Lopez at Cambridge.
I come from Spain. People are jumping out of the balconies because they're being evicted because of all these austerity measures, that they cannot pay their mortgage, they've lost their jobs. You know, youth unemployment is above 50%. Food banks, you know, there's three new food banks in England every week. There's reality out there that is just knocking at the door, and the lecture theatres seem to be totally disconnected from this social reality.
And so the students have reacted as students have done since time immemorial, by protesting. This time, they're fighting professors to make their courses more relevant, broader, human. In the past few months, the students' movement has spread from Glasgow to Calcutta, and it keeps growing.
In America, we have student groups in New York City, Washington, D.C.
At Boston University in Istanbul, our student group has successful
petitions.
Try to incorporate the spirit into what we are doing in China.
My name's Aditya Chakraborty, and as The Guardian's senior economics commentator, I've spent the past couple of years covering this battle for the minds of the next generation of economists. In this programme, you'll hear leading economists talk about why they believe their discipline has gone so badly wrong.
Over the past 30 years, there has been what I would call an economic homicide in the subject.
And the chief economist at the Bank of England, among others, assesses the human cost of having the wrong economics.
Are you saying that failure of economists in top universities to come up with realistic models for the way the world works means that people are now out of work when they needn't be, not getting pay rises when they needn't be? Is that what you're saying?
For sure, we should all hold up our hands and say, yes, we were part and parcel of causing what we've seen.
Welcome to the first post-crash economics event of the year. It's called What You Won't Learn in Your Economics Degree. Profusely apologise for the lack of beer. We bought a 72-pint keg and unfortunately got taken from us.
This is what student rebellion looks like in autumn 2014, 100 undergraduates in a room, eating outsized pizza and arguing over what's wrong with their economics degrees.
Narrow and a few completely redundant economics modules that don't actually explain anything or very little about the world that we actually live in. So, for example, I learned a model of pure consumption, but I've never actually been sat down and told what the function of a bank is.
At Manchester's post-crash economic society, the students don't agree with what they're studying or how it's taught. Like many of today's most interesting protest movements, the post-crash society has grown up in the long shadow cast by the banking meltdown.
If there was another way, some easier way, I would take it. But there is no alternative.
We've still got a huge amount to do to reduce the deficit and to get our debts falling.
Take Joe Earle, who went up to Manchester University the year after David Cameron moved into Downing Street and embarked on historic spending cuts. Outside, the public arguments about economics were fierce and urgent. Nobel laureates were slugging it out over the effects of austerity. But inside the lecture theatres, Joe believed he and his fellow students were being taught little more than dogma.
Economics was in a state of uncertainty and in a place where it didn't have all the answers. Then to come to uni and to find people saying, this is how it works, learn it, recite it, and we'll do a multiple choice test for you at the end of the year. And one of the things I will never forget is when an economics student came up to me and said, I feel so embarrassed when my friends and family say, what's going on with the financial crisis? And I just don't know what to tell them. I don't feel like anything I've learned can explain to them satisfactorily what's going on.
By second year, he and fellow undergraduates were so fed up, they'd launched a post-crash economic society. They held lectures and reading groups to go through classic texts like Keynes and Marx, the kind of thing they weren't reading on their course.
We specifically wanted to kind of ask our professors what was going on and why we weren't getting a better economics education. We had a list of problems that we thought was wrong with economics. Lack of alternative perspectives, lack of history or context, that could include politics. It included lack of critical thinking and lack of real-world application.
The students weren't alone in feeling frustrated. Popular economics lecturer Dr. Devrim Yilmaz found himself embarrassed by what he was teaching.
I was lecturing macroeconomics when the world was coming apart. As you can guess, my students were continuously asking me about this. Every day, every lecture, what's going on? Why is this happening?
At the students' request, Devrim began a class called Bubbles, Panics and Crashes. In their own time on Monday nights, tutor and undergraduates would trace the history of how the world they were about to merge into had fallen apart.
Most economic students would graduate without learning the history of crisis. First of all, like what happened, why it happened, and how the economies recovered from this. I mean, if you stop any economic student from almost any university in the UK and ask them why did the Asian crisis happen and how did the Asian economies come out of these crises, they would probably ask you what is the Asian crisis.
Devrim's evening class would trigger a civil war in his department. The course of his entire career would drastically change. More on that in a bit, but first, let's examine the criticisms made by Joe and Devrim. Take that last point about what economics graduates don't know. I put it to the test, asking three of Manchester's brightest third-year economics students some basic yet fun questions. They knew the rough size of the UK economy, you'll be relieved to hear, but listen to the rest. What's world GDP in dollars?
Well, we actually learn analysis, not just learning numbers by heart, so again, I have to pass. I do not know what the world GDP is.
It would be a stab in the dark, probably somewhere in the region of about 60 trillion.
40, 42, 43.
Okay.
Very pessimistic about the world economy. It's somewhere between 80 trillion and 87 trillion. In which year did Adam Smith publish The Wealth of Nations?
I've no idea.
Somewhere around 1779.
Yes, I just know 17. I guess we do need more alternatives.
1776, the year America declared independence.
Right.
When was the Bank of England nationalised?
Hold on, nationalised? Taken over by the government again?
No, it became independent at some point.
In the very first time it became a government... It started as a government entity, as far as I know.
Okay. It happened under Clement Attlee. It was nationalised. It began as a private institution, which was all run by banks in the city to help themselves.
There we go. Learned something new.
Let's be clear. These are smart students. Two have already been offered jobs by major city firms. They're excellent at economics. But, on the admittedly limited basis of this quiz, they don't know some of the basic stuff you might expect them to about the economy. A modern economics degree nearly anywhere, not just at Manchester, doesn't teach that stuff. Then there's the divide between mainstream economics and all the other perspectives. What does that mean? Well, listen to this. Two economists go down the pub. No, not the setup for an unpromising joke, but a conversation between Danny Qua, LSE professor and self-proclaimed neoclassical, he's on the ginger ale, and, sipping fizzy water, Dr. Harjun Chang, Cambridge economist and decidedly heterodox in his views. Their different approaches mean they see the world completely differently, even on the simple matter of getting a drink.
As a neoclassical-based economist, we construct a collection of alternatives, and then we look at those options, and we say, what is it that I can do, given the time, given my budget? And of those that are feasible, I choose the best option. Mm. But Harjun, you would like us to think about things differently.
I think that humans are more complex. We are creatures of habit, and also people's preferences are shaped by the environment. So, for example, when I first came to this country in the 1980s, it was very rare for working-class people in this country to drink wine, because it was almost an act of class treachery. Today, they are drinking wine. One reason might be that they are more willing to break out of this class consumption pattern, which you didn't see in the 1980s. And this is an interesting insight that you can learn from studying Marxist economics.
Rational choice theory, as sketched out by Danny, begins by treating humans as walking calculators who know what they want and how to get it. Following Marx, Keynes and others, Harjun, on the other hand, assumes that we are much more social and easily influenced. Outside the saloon bar, Danny's way of analysing the world is the one that dominates economics faculties. Harjun? Well, listen to how being outside the mainstream has affected his Cambridge career.
A life of persecution and struggle, if I may put it that way. They don't promote you, telling the students that you are a crank. You know? They shut down your course, which happened to me. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very unpleasant life. And, of course, they'll have a good excuse. They'll say, oh, he hasn't published in these top journals. You know? And then people like me go out in the real world and write books for the popular market and sell 1.5 million copies. They say it's still not good enough because you cannot trust these ignorant masses. But then success in the market is the best indicator. But when it comes to their turf, they don't admit it, you know?
The way modern academics get ahead is by publishing articles in the most prestigious journals in their field. Except, in economics, there's a problem. Professor Steve Keen is another non-mainstream economist.
Neoclassical economists edit all the major journals, the Economic Journal, the American Economic Review, the Quarterly Journal of Economics. All of these journals, which are top-ranked, are in fact filtered by a neoclassical economist as editor. That means that people like myself don't get published in those so-called leading journals. And it's really as if you had a discipline called religion, where it just happened that the Vatican edited all the top journals, and therefore anybody who was a Muslim or a Buddhist would be rated as a low-quality religious person.
If that were to be the case, then we wouldn't have the teachings of the Buddha and we wouldn't have the Quran.
Yeah, that's right. We would have them, but no, they wouldn't be read. They'd be minority, truly minority elements, and they'd be forever battling against a totally dominant Catholic Church. In economics, just one particular majority sect has the monopoly on teaching economics across the whole globe.
The result is to make the subject narrower than it's ever been.
I'm going to name you some famous economists of yesteryear, and you tell me whether you think they'd get published in any of the top journals.
Okay.
Let's start with John Maynard Keynes. Would he get published in the American Economic Review?
No. where he talks about the monetary system and instability and role of uncertainty, that goes against what the modern mob call rational expectations. And they think if you don't have rational expectations in your model, that's really bad.
Hayek.
So his vision about uncertainty, lack of information and instability would also be rejected from any mainstream journal.
I'm not having much luck. Let me try Schumpeter.
Schumpeter would get rejected because he had a cyclical vision of capitalism.
Hyman Minsky.
Oh, absolutely not.
These legendary names may have no future in academia, but they're precisely the ones who've proved most useful to understanding the crash and its aftermath. Yet, over the past three decades, the economists who followed their teachings and other traditions outside the mainstream have been weeded out of their departments. No wonder Manchester students such as Maeve Cohen feel so shortchanged.
I was amazed at what the economics was that I was learning. I didn't recognise it to be what I understood as economics at all. And I assumed there'd be discussion and I assumed that we would be talking about the real world. But actually, it was just incredibly abstract theory and only one theory, which didn't help explain anything at all. I still didn't know what Paul Mason was talking about.
Her doubts about the usefulness of mainstream economics are echoed right at the top of the field. We went to talk to George Soros. The world-famous investor told us his economics training was useless when it came to navigating markets.
I personally did not follow the economics that I was taught because already as a student I became aware of a flaw in economic theory. Some of the prevailing theories like calculations of risk were flawed because they ignored uncertainty. The techniques of controlling risk, which was, pure math, were very far developed, and people fell in love with it. And because of that, they forgot the risk that cannot be quantified. People can actually influence reality. They have an impact. Mainstream economics eliminated it, forgot it, and that came back to haunt it.
My name's Aditya Chakraborty, and you're listening to Teaching Economics After the Crash on BBC Radio 4. The picture painted by both students and non-mainstream economists is of a social science that's keen on being a science than on having an accurate grasp of society. And yet, over the past 30 years, it shaped our society and our politics more than any other discipline.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
Dr. Victoria Bateman teaches economic history at Cambridge.
At the fundamental root cause of the crisis is the belief of economists in the free market capitalist system. And the result of this growing faith that really began in the 1980s with the rise of Margaret Thatcher and with Reagan in the US, the result of that belief was a liberalisation of markets, privatisation, the rolling back of the state, deregulation of the financial sector, and so we began to experience full-blown capitalism, that it could be set forth free rein and the result would be low unemployment, inflation that was under control, respectable, even high economic growth rates. The result was that on the eve of the global financial crisis, economists were looking ahead and imagining a rather rosy future. You know, we were basically on the Titanic with all of the great glory that this free market capitalist model promised. And economists were entirely unaware of some of the problems that this was creating behind the scenes.
Take mainstream economics out of the textbooks and into the real world, and what do you get?
The world economy has grown much more slowly.
Harjun Chang, author of Economics, The User's Guide.
Become much more unequal and has become more unstable. So growth being slowed down means that living standard doesn't rise as fast as it could have been. You know, pre-con financial crisis that create unemployment, increasing inequality that harms social cohesion, and the society becomes more unpleasant to live in. So the human cost of having wrong kind of economics has been enormous.
But the really big blow to the standing of mainstream economics came from the meltdown of 2008. It was a crash that hardly any economist saw coming, and the ones who did were almost all from outside the mainstream. Among them was Steve Keen, author of Debunking Economics.
Everything they did about setting up an armchair view gave them a view effectively of a village from 5,000 years ago before credit and money had been invented. And that's how they try to model modern capitalism.
You said that economics doesn't really take much account of money and banks and debt. But a lot of people listening will think, hang on, that's exactly what economics is about, isn't
exactly.
it?
And the people who are listening are right and the economists are wrong. And the mainstream mantra basically says that money is just a veil over barter. What's actually going on behind all those money transactions is, in fact, just people exchanging one commodity for another. And money is basically irrelevant. All money gives you is the rate of inflation. It doesn't tell you anything real about the economy. And they then drill that into people's heads in first year. And if they survive all the way to a PhD, they actually believe it.
So you're saying effectively that mainstream economics misses out on how banks actually function,
mm-hmm.
and in doing so, they therefore miss out on the creation of debt,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
And therefore, that when we have a huge crisis caused by too much debt, mainstream economics is no help to us whatsoever.
No, not even no help. It tells us don't even bother looking at that information. So rather than saying we have to monitor the level of bank lending and how big it is compared to the GDP and whether it's growing or shrinking at the time, they basically say ignore it. There are many, many steps at which that model falls over, but they continue teaching it because it's this nice, coherent, neat, plausible and wrong model of the world. And then that gets in people's minds and it becomes the religion of economics.
A big charge, but over at the Bank of England, Chief Economist Andy Haldane pleads guilty.
At the root of the crisis we are living through, which has had as material impact on people's livelihoods as anything for at least 70 or 80 years, at the root of that was actually an intellectual failing, an analytical failing. The model we were using to understand the world turned out to be false. And therefore, the policies we put in place turned out to be inadequate. And the costs of that are now being felt by everyone.
Are you saying that the failure of economists in top universities to come up with realistic models for the way the world works means that people are now out of work when they needn't be, not getting pay rises when they needn't be? Is that what you're saying?
The analytical failures of the profession certainly played their part in contributing to what we've been doing through for the last 5 or 6 years. Were they the only explanation? Of course, they were not. But for sure, we should all hold up our hands and say, yes, we were part and parcel of causing what we've seen.
That calamitous failure has given dissenting student Yuan Yang a ready audience.
Since our first conference a year and a half ago at the LSE, we've expanded really quickly. There have been lots of local groups in places all over the world, from Beijing to New York, wanting to set up their own events and set up their own groups.
This spring, students from around the world together wrote a manifesto calling for reform of economics.
We believe our economy is broken and we want to find new ways to fix it through rethinking economics.
United across borders, we call for a change of course.
Change will be difficult. It always is. But it is already happening.
A truly international effort. It was conceived, written and launched within weeks.
Incredible when you think that we've never actually met each other, yet we have all the same concerns. And we speak, in some ways, we speak the same language when we talk about our aims.
Their open letter to professors has been signed by 65 student groups from 30 different countries. Yuan gives us a flavour.
We are dissatisfied with the dramatic narrowing of the curriculum that has taken place over the last couple of decades. This lack of intellectual diversity does not only restrain education and research, it also limits our ability to contend with the challenges of the 21st century, from financial stability to food security and climate change. The real world should be brought back into the classroom and ultimately create a space in which solutions to society's problems can be generated. It got translated from English, very quickly into French and German, Danish, into Chinese, into Mandarin, simplified Chinese and traditional Chinese, and there was Japanese translation, Spanish, Portuguese.
But what was happening with the economists at Manchester? Well, A big fight was breaking out over the Bubbles, Panics and Crashes module, the course that lecturer Dr. Devrim Yilmaz and undergraduates were doing in their spare time. Student Joe Earle remembers how the battle began at the start of this year.
It answered all of our criticisms of what we were being taught. We assumed that that was going to be put on as a module the year after, and that was the kind of tacit understanding we'd left it the year before. The problem was, when we got to January, we were told by Devrim that it wasn't going to be put on. And from that point, we started a campaign in which we managed to get 250 economic students to sign a petition saying they wanted that module. We managed to get support from senior members of the faculty, the head of the two main courses.
Devrim says that while some of his colleagues were supportive, others began to freeze him out.
And I was told that my contract will be extended and the module will run. But then, about 2 to 3 weeks after we were told, this decision was reversed entirely. And I was told that my contract will not be extended, and the post-crash was told there will be no Bubbles module in 2014-15.
In the end, it was vetoed by a small group of professors in the department. And from that point on, it was clear that Devrim would probably finish.
Manchester has a lot of economics teachers, and the students were only asking for one optional module. It was evidently asking too much. Although on a temporary contract, Devrim had been teaching at Manchester for years. He left this summer.
The problem is for us and for students across the country who are doing similar things, and for academics who are thinking, oh, maybe I'll teach something for them, the message is very loud and clear: don't stick your head above the parapet.
The Post-Crash Society hit back by marking down the economics faculty in the all-important National Student Survey, or NSS. Economics at Manchester now has the lowest NSS score of all the departments at the university. But not all students agree with what the Post-Crash Society did. Take one of our earlier quiz takers.
Running such a campaign endangers the way the department looks, and not everybody's unhappy. Post-crash is a society, but not everybody within the university and within economics feels the way post-crash feels, and they don't deserve to have their degree program devalued in any way by what post-crash's opinion is.
One response by the faculty has been to hire some big names from the real world, indeed from some of its most desirable postcodes. So former Goldman Sachs economist Jim O'Neill was now on board. There's also a new professor of public policy, Vice Chair of the BBC Trust, Diane Coyle, who wants to defend her colleagues.
I think there's a danger of reading too much into that specific example, because it suggests that this is a department that's particularly recalcitrant and stuffed with people who are part of that monolithic, neoclassical mainstream, and it's just not true. There's a very wide range of views, and they have responded more to students than most other departments in the country. They're launching a very wide-ranging curriculum review. It might well decide that there needs to be a course that offers heterodox economics or post-Keynesian economics. Meanwhile, there is a financial crises course available to the students in the business school. It's across the road. It takes them 2 minutes to get there. And it's a course that would teach about the causes of financial crises. It's just pig-headed not to say that's not good enough.
Diane's not straight out of some economics politburo. She too wants the curriculum to be more grounded in the real world, but disagrees on the need for different perspectives.
What's bad about what post-crash are calling for?
I think one thing is they have this fixation on schools of thought. They have this idea that there is a monolithic, neoclassical school of thought that's dominated economics departments and the curriculum for a long time, and that it needs to switch to a different school of thought, heterodox, or at least introduce lots of different schools of thoughts. I think that's going backwards. That's going back to the economics of the 1930s and those almost medieval scholastic debates about what your worldview was.
Diane has chipped into the CORE project, a revamped introductory curriculum in economics that's just begun a pilot at University College London. The lead author is Professor Wendy Carlin.
The CORE project is animated by the idea that we can teach a new introduction course in economics rooted in the problems of the real world, so problems of instability, inequality, problems of environmental degradation. So this is a beginning, I think, in changing the way the core of economics is taught.
Asking the student reformers what they think of CORE is a bit like asking a vegetarian if they fancy McDonald's now it sells salad. They can see the effort, but it's not quite what they're after. At the Cambridge Society for Economic Pluralism, Diana Garcia-Lopez.
CORE is giving us an updated version of mainstream economics. So they do try to connect a little bit to current issues, but it is still within the same framework of one single coherent view of economic theories. And we call for pluralism in terms of methodologies, schools of thought, and interdisciplinarity. And CORE ticks none of those boxes.
Philip Morovsky, author of Never Let a Serious Crisis Go to Waste.
The poor students who want something different and are even told that they're getting something different are basically getting more of the same. Where I come from, this is called lipstick on a pig. This is the instantiation of that famous quote that there is no alternative. That's the way the economics profession behaves.
Non-mainstream thinkers may not be at the core of CORE, but, says Wendy Carlin, they do feature.
The CORE introduction to economics is not a history of thought course. But on the other hand, it uses insights from many different schools and thinkers in economics, from Schumpeter, from Hayek, from Marx. So I think we're very open to influences, whether they be called pluralist, mainstream, wherever they come from.
Funding the CORE project is the Institute for New Economic Thinking, or INET, set up with money from George Soros. Rob Johnson's head of INET, and even he's rather lukewarm.
There's always a trade-off between what can be absorbed in the profession, what are they willing to change toward relative to their habits, and what is the most impactful new economic thinking that you can imagine. The ideal curriculum probably would be adopted by maybe four departments in the world. So there's a lot of resistance to change.
But then how will mainstream economics, and by extension the society it interprets and shapes, change? Max Planck once observed that science progresses one funeral at a time. Not a bad joke for a German theoretical physicist, but it's also a serious point that only by replacing the champions of an old idea will you get rid of the idea itself. Which is why Victoria Bateman looks to her students to save her subject.
Really, what we need is fresh thinking, young minds. And I say this to my students, that when they're reading the textbooks, this is not the end state of understanding, that we still need to find a path forward. And actually, it's their experiences coming in from the real world out there could potentially be the saviour of the subject.
Maybe, but most undergraduates only hang around for 3 years. Their opponents on the faculty will be there for life. And, says economic historian Lord Robert Skidelsky, the greybeards have vested interests on their side.
You have an establishment, and that establishment is very durable, and very few people break the mould of it. The ideas in office, the ideas that succeed, are ideas that are usually acceptable to the power holders in society. They're the ones that are called scientific, and all the others are called nonsense.
If, as critics say, mainstream economics is deluded, then it pays to be deluded. The rich and powerful reward those academics who come up with scientific-sounding reasons for why they should have wealth and power, says billionaire George Soros.
Well, let's say, take this fundamental misconception in general equilibrium theory, which is that in general equilibrium produces the optimum allocation of resources, and markets, being perfect, allocate resources the most efficient way. Now, this happens to be a false, because markets are not perfect. But it's a very convenient belief for those who are benefiting from financial markets, the rich and powerful.
Yet nearly everyone we spoke to for this programme accepted that economics had to change, even if they disagreed over how much. At the Bank of England, Andy Haldane.
The Bank of England held a day, not so long ago, called something like "Are Economics Graduates Fit for Purpose?" What's the answer?
Not yet.
We'll use the 4 minute long silence.
It means we need to bring back, in some cases,
onto the curriculum features which we know now to be fundamental to understanding what's going on. That means risk, that means financial sector, that means systems that sometimes fall over or break apart. All of that needs now to become part of the mainstream if we are to make sense of what has happened in the memory of the next generation of students.
INET's Rob Johnson.
The knowledge of people and the quality of their education and their ability to formulate, which you might call sophisticated and sound judgments, that's the responsibility of education. When education is as bad as economics has been in recent years, you're not just doing a disservice to the students, you're doing a disservice to the entire society.
The battle of a bunch of teenagers for change in the most influential social science matters to all of us. Paul Samuelson once said, "I don't care who writes a nation's laws or crafts its advanced treaties if I can write its economics textbooks." He should know. He wrote perhaps the biggest-selling economics textbook of all time. The people who write the replacement set texts will be producing the instruction manual for our society. Let's give the last word to the students.
What goes on in academia and our struggle really has implications that go into houses and into schools and into hospitals and really ultimately the future prosperity of humanity.
There's a lot of things that people are really worried about, like inequality and sustainability, and none of these things really get a look in within the models that we're learning. And if we want, for example, to create a sustainable future, we're going to have to change the way that our economic institutions work.
Students enroll in economics degrees because they want to understand what's going on and they want to be able to come up with better ways of doing things. The world has changed, but the syllabus hasn't. Surely we have to do something about this.
Teaching Economics After the Crash was written and presented by Aditya Chakraborty and produced by Eve Streeter. It was a Greenpoint production for BBC Radio 4.